Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I can barely hear myself, so that must be, I must have done something wrong, but that's not true. I'm all better now. I can hear everything. So moving forward, we're going to dive into the Constitutional Convention. Again, the debt is fraud. Now or never. It's all focusing on the Constitution. Well, we're at a point of evolution of our government that they're now creating this. And as we're looking at what Madison did in kickstarting the convention, and Madison was very integral. I didn't even get into how he convinced Washington to attend. There's a lot of people that thought that Shays' Rebellion was the motivation. Washington was not concerned about Shays' Rebellion. And so do you know what Washington was concerned about? But the one thing that was keeping his focus and why he wasn't going to attend the convention, do you know what it was? It was his attending of the Society of Cincinnati. It was an age, or I should say it was an organization of an aristocracy that was kind of forming in America. And he was so prominent that he was looking at being selected as a leader of the Society of Cincinnati. Now people can look it up and go into the details, but this is where his focus was. He was kind of wanting to, put an end to his life and career of, public service and everything else, yada, yada, yada. And so he wasn't looking for more public service. Well, he was not responding to Madison's letters, and Madison was concerned. And I think by the time Madison reached out to General Knox, because General Knox was very close friends with Washington. And as a matter of fact, they were so close that General Knox became the first Secretary of War. And it was General Knox who wrote a letter to Washington to say, look, if you haven't noticed, we may not have a country if we don't do something. That this convention in Philadelphia is that necessary. That it is my advice to you, as a friend as well as a confidant, that you need to focus on attending this convention and not worry about the Society of Cincinnati. That's the letter that got Washington focused in attending, and he finally came out and said, yes, I will attend. He was invited by the state of Virginia. Why not? I mean, out of all of the Virginians who were in Virginia at the time, who was greater than him? And the next guy wasn't even in Virginia. He was out in France at the time serving the nation, serving the country. It was Thomas Jefferson, Colonel Mason, and Patrick Henry was another one. But, I mean, Jefferson and Washington were huge. And if you really look at, what the contributions that Virginia made to the Constitution, to the early forming of America and its stability, because we kind of cover this with the five critical documents of how Adams, from Massachusetts, being willing to actually take draconian measures and take away the freedom of speech and so forth and so on, where, it was the Virginians that brought rational, limited government back, to America when Adams decided to deviate or part away from that. So anyway. So getting back to the Virginia plan, we kind of left off where Randolph was going through these paragraphs of resolutions and so forth. And so we're now on the fifth resolution. Now, Sean, at any point in time, something, that jumps out or something like that, by all means, just say, hey, hold on here. What about this? Or as you can tell, there's blanks. They didn't want to come in and stipulate what the numbers of years of service, those types of things. But they just wanted to make sure that they kind of laid out a plan that there would be limited times of service. You know, you could come in and serve, and then following the Articles of Confederation. If you really look at what Hamilton or Madison was doing here, not Hamilton, he was really kind of following those same term limitations and so forth that they had, and were trying to inject those changes into the Articles of Confederation. So let's go ahead and pick up with the fifth resolution.
Resolved that the members of the second branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by those of the first, out of a proper number of persons nominated by the individual legislatures, to be of the age of blank years at least, to hold their offices for a term sufficient to ensure their independency, to receive liberal stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, and to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under authority of the United States, except those peculiarly belonging to the functions of the second branch during the term of service and for the space of blank after the expiration thereof.
Okay.
So over 250 years and we still don't have term limits.
Well, it came up back then. The solution was vote them out.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love the meme where they had the older gentleman with the coffee and he goes, oh, they rigged the election. Time to vote them out.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay.
Resolved. Number six, resolved that each branch ought to possess the right of originating acts, that the national legislature ought to be empowered to enjoy the legislative rights vested in Congress by the Confederation, and moreover to legislate in all cases to which the separate states are incompetent, or in which the harmony of the United States may be interrupted by the exercise of individual legislation, to negative all laws passed by the several states, contravening in the opinion of the national legislature the Articles of Union, and to call forth the force of the Union against any member of the Union failing to fulfill its duty under the Articles thereof.
Yeah, now you can imagine that the fact that the federal government would be able to go after and shut down any state legislature's bills, you could clearly see how Madison was really creating a very powerful central government. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, that's a bit much.
Yeah, it was. So again, just keep in mind that what Madison put on the table got rejected. And some of this stuff was, you know, the fur kind of flew a little bit, if you know what I mean. And here's the guy that came up with the plan thinking that this was the best plan he could come up with. And it was rejected. I mean, there were really significant parts. And wow, I mean, it was like, I could see people equating it to kicking their dog. Because some people take this authorship, pride in authorship or what have you, very, very seriously. But Madison wasn't that way at all. Wasn't that way at all. He was going with the flow. He just got everything kickstarted. That's good. That's just what I planned. I wanted to get everything started. There we go. So go ahead, seven.
Or perhaps, I mean, it sounds like negotiating to me, where you put that out there so that you can have the argument, and knowing that full well that's not what you intend is for this end, but you put it out there to the extent to where you can argue it back to a point that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so if you don't put it out there.
Trump negotiates. Oh, we're going to take Greenland by force if they don't give it to us. And then they all go, oh, and he goes, oh, okay.
And then
you give them the worst case scenario off the bat, so that way you can work it to something that's more temperate.
Sure.
Yeah, seven, resolved that a national executive be instituted to be chosen by the national legislature for the term of blank years, to receive punctually at stated times a fixed compensation for the services rendered, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the magistracy existing at the time of increase or diminution, and to be ineligible a second time, and that besides the general authority to execute national laws, it ought to enjoy the executive rights vested in Congress by the Confederation.
Okay, so also notice that there's no retirement at all. You serve, yes, and then you go away. Keep going.
Yeah, and then also I noticed there's only one term for the executive.
Right. Well, so, yeah, and when we get to Hamilton's plan, you're going to see how Hamilton was, and it's much later, too, by the way. It's after, I think, the Roger Sherman Compromise. I mean, they finally figured out the direction to go, where the president could serve as many terms as necessary, and, you know, everything was pretty much going to be done where the voters had to decide whether they wanted to keep these crooks or not, so forth and so on. So, anyway, as it moved forward, it was Hamilton that came up with the idea, or basically wanted to see an executive that would be permanent. Yeah.
So I hate that guy more every time.
Yeah, okay. Keep going.
Also, I wanted to comment about, they were talking about, they even said it explicitly earlier, that you're only going to serve this many times to, or, you know, make sure you have independency. Because the longer you're in there, the more power you're going to accrue.
Right. And the more dependent you are, because now, you know, if you're not spending your time building your farm, that's your business, right? That's a family business.
Mm-hmm.
And you're building, you know, politics and government, then what are you farming?
Right.
You're becoming dependent, and your family becomes dependent on you working in politics, law, and so forth. So, okay, keep going.
Number 8, resolved that the executive and a convenient number of the national judiciary ought to compose a council of revision with authority to examine every act of the national legislature before it shall operate, and every act of a particular legislature before a negative thereon shall be final, and that the dissent of the said council shall amount to a rejection, unless the act of the national legislature be again passed, or that of a particular legislature be again negatived by blank of the members of each branch.
Okay, so now we're looking at a judiciary that could literally reach out and actually engage itself and create a negative on the laws. That the national judiciary ought to compose of council of revision with authority to examine every act of the national legislature before it shall operate, giving them a negative on it, being able to veto. Mm-hmm. They didn't give them that, did they?
No.
No.
Well, eventually they did.
Okay, so one of the beautiful things about doing what we're doing now, by reading what they were proposing, then we can see what they took away, because as we learned in the bill for the bank bill, Madison's argument and comment came out as such, that during the convention, it was considered giving the federal government the ability to create charters and to create corporations. That idea was rejected. So you learn a lot more about how rigid the limitations were when you think, well, surely they would have thought about giving us a charter and the ability to create corporations, because that just seems like what good governments do. And yet, no, we considered it and we rejected it on its face. That's a big difference than, well, they didn't think about it, but surely they should have thought about it. And, well, we're just going to go ahead and do it. No. It was thought about and denied. So don't even think about bringing it in now. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, great.
And just like this part that we just read, where this was proposed and apparently rejected, and I'm sure that there was more discussion of it as it went along as to why the judiciary should be the weakest branch and should only be have a jurisdiction that entailed certain things.
Right.
You know, they could foresee, and they explain why,
yes,
they don't want that.
Yeah, so this is how I say reading those things that were put on the table and knocked off with prejudice, knocked off with, are you kidding me? Or argued and debated, and when they actually looked at all sides, said, that's not going to fly, and got rid of it for whatever logical reason. There were those types of things. Going through this helps people see and understand things that they had no idea. This is one of the reasons why, when we read the Constitution, if you remember, I had you read the amendments that never passed. In other words, the amendments that were rejected. Why is that important? Because we can learn a lot in what government sought to do and was rejected. Say, are you kidding? We're not giving you that power to regulate labor in 1926.
And I think it also lends to quashing any interpretation that, like in the general welfare clause or, you know, other things that people say, oh, well, you know, this is what they meant. No, this is what they meant because they said it right here on this day.
Precisely, and this is a profound approach. It is an irrefutable approach by literally saying that these things were laid out, this is what was said, and this is why it was done that way. So sit down, shut up, and pay attention.
Your eye poking again.
There we go. All right, let's keep going. Thank you.
Number 9. Resolve that a national judiciary be established consist of one or more supreme tribunals and of inferior tribunals to be chosen by the national legislature to hold their officers during good behavior and to receive punctually at stated times fixed compensation for their services, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the persons actually in office at the time of such increase or diminution, that the jurisdiction of the inferior tribunals shall be to hear and determine in the first instance, and of the supreme tribunal to hear and determine in the dernier resort, all piracies and felonies on the high seas, captures from an enemy, cases in which foreigners or citizens of other states applying to such jurisdictions may be interested, or which respect the collection of the national revenue, impeachments of any national officers, and questions which may involve national peace and harmony.
Keep going.
Number 10, resolved that provision ought to be made for the admission of states lawfully arising within the limits of the United States, whether from a voluntary junction of government and territory or otherwise, with the consent of a number of voices in the national legislature less than the whole.
Okay, right here, over, across the way, or wherever Continental Congress was sitting, they were already debating and trying to devise the Northwest Ordinance. Now, this Northwest Ordinance had been around for a long time because the original author was Thomas Jefferson. And so Thomas Jefferson kind of pinned that, and it just sat out there. Well, now that they got to a point where Ohio was looking to come into the Union, they're saying, hey, we need to do something about this. We need to create a mechanism because the Articles of Confederation don't allow us to add states to the Union. So they already knew that this was a problem, and they made sure that they put it on there that new states would be able to join into the Union. And they kind of laid it out here, but they didn't lay out any of the absurd things that came up later. So anyway, let's keep going. Thanks.
Resolved. Number 11. Resolved that a Republican government and the territory of each state, except in the instance of a voluntary junction of government and territory, ought to be guaranteed by the United States to each state. Number 12. Resolved that the provision ought to be made for the continuance of Congress and their authorities and privileges until a given day after the reform of the Articles of Union shall be adopted, and for the completion of all their engagements. 13. Resolved that provision ought to be made for the amendment of the Articles of Union whensoever it shall seem necessary, and that the assent of the national legislature ought not to be required thereto. Hear, hear. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Yep.
I had that right? They're saying that the Congress has nothing to do with amendments.
Correct.
It's the states that decide them.
Uh-huh, correct.
14, resolved that the legislative, executive, and judiciary powers within the several states ought to be bound by oath to support the Articles of the Union. Number 15, resolved that the amendments which shall be offered to the Confederation by the Convention ought at a proper time or times after the approbation of Congress to be submitted to an assembly or assemblies of representatives recommended by the several legislatures to be expressly chosen by the people to consider and decide thereon.
Okay, so now that's it. That's the Virginia plan. Pretty simple, but it's a start. And now the South Carolina delegates kind of go, hey, you know, while they're presenting the plan, let's kind of kick something off ourselves. Or maybe they had this prepared. I don't know. I can't tell you. But they presented a plan that followed the Virginia plan based on the notes. And it was the same day, May 29th, that basically the Pinckney plan, or Mr. Charles Coatsworth, I think it's Charles Pinckney, not Coatsworth Pinckney, gets up and says, hey, and go ahead and read that part.
Is it labeled South Carolina?
No, it says the Pinckney plan. It's literally right after, it's in yellow. The Pinckney plan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's right there.
I didn't see.
Right where you left off, right where you kind of left off, resolved, he concluded the exhortations, Mr. Randolph. Right, the Pinckney plan.
All right. Oh, wait, looking further, and it was right there?
Yeah, it's right there. Oh, so what it is, folks, is this is where Mr. Pinckney gets up and he presents and puts in front of everybody a draft of a plan. So they had something ready as well, but they didn't have the time to dive into it so that they figured that they would consider it, you know, down the road. Okay?
Mr. Charles Pinckney laid before the House the draft of a federal government which he had prepared to be agreed upon between the free and independent states of America. Mr. Pinckney's plan ordered that same be referred to the Committee of the Whole appointed to consider the state of the American Union.
Okay.
On Wednesday.
Right. So what we want to read here are the highlighted parts now. Because what we read was really everything of the Virginia plan. This is the first time we really dove into it. I wanted everybody to understand what they threw on the table as, you know, these resolutions of trying to fix the Articles of Confederation. So Mr. Sherman now gets up and starts speaking. So go ahead.
The House went into committee of the whole on the State of the Union. Mr. Gorham was elected to the chair by ballot. The propositions of Mr. Randolph, which had been referred to the committee, being taken up, he moved on the suggestion of Mr. Governor Morris that the first of his propositions, to wit, resolve that the Articles of Confederation ought to be so corrected and enlarged as to accomplish the objects proposed by their institution. Namely, common defense, security of liberty, and general welfare should be postponed in order to consider the three following. One, that a union of states merely federal will not accomplish the objects proposed by the Articles of Confederation, namely, common defense, security of liberty, and general welfare. Two, that no treaty or treaties among the whole or part of the states as individual sovereignties would be sufficient. Three, that a national government ought to be established consisting of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary. The motion for postponing was seconded by Mr. Governor Morris and unanimously agreed to. Some verbal criticisms were raised against the first proposition, and it was agreed on motion of Mr. Butler.
Okay, so unfortunately, we're going to have Sean go back to that because, believe it or not, this break kind of snuck up on us. So, and this happens when we start really diving in and looking and focusing on the content. So forgive us for kind of bleeding in. We'll just get back and do a little retrack when we come back from the short break. Thank you.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so sorry I did not see this break coming up because we're diving into this. And as a matter of fact, there's some really good points that are being brought up at this juncture, as a matter of fact. So go ahead and kind of pick it up with the number one. Or do you know where you kind of left off before the break kicked in? Do you know?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So go ahead and pick up where you were prior to the break kicking in. Thanks.
Some verbal criticisms were raised against the first proposition, and it was agreed on motion of Mr. Butler, seconded by Mr. Randolph, to pass on to the third, which underwent a discussion less, however, on its general merits than on the force and extent of the particular terms national and supreme. Mr. Charles Pinckney wished to know of Mr. Randolph whether he meant to abolish the state governments altogether. Mr. R. replied that he meant by these general propositions merely to introduce the particular ones which explained the outlines of the system he had in view.
So they were They were already starting to sniff. This was going to be a real centralized government where the states were going to be reduced to administrative states. Now, whether Randolph was soft-pedaling, that was Madison's intent. Madison really did sell this as a very vigorous, very energetic central government, and that the states would really be administrative support. And so, which is huge. In other words, they were really creating a federation, not a confederation, not maintaining a confederation, which, again, went well beyond, you know, this concept of the sovereignties that the states wanted to maintain, which is one of the reasons why the questions were being asked the way they were. So keep going. Go ahead. Mr. Butler.
Mr. Butler said he had not made up his mind on the subject and was open to the light which discussion might throw on it. After some general observations, he concluded with saying that he had opposed the grant of powers to Congress heretofore because the whole power was vested in one body. The proposed distribution of powers into different bodies changed the case and would induce him to go great lengths.
Okay, so those things, again, this was really in the raw form. And they were talking about, obviously, looking in aspects of checks and balances. Keep going, General Pinckney.
Express a doubt whether the act of Congress recommending the convention or the commission of the deputies to it could authorize a discussion of a system founded on different principles from the federal Constitution. Mr. Gary seemed to entertain the same doubt. Mr. Governor Morris explained the distinction between a federal and national supreme government, the former being a mere compact resting on the good faith of the parties, the latter having a complete and compulsive operation. He contended that in all communities there must be one supreme power and one only.
Okay, so go ahead. Was there a pause?
Mr. Mason observed that the present Confederation was not only deficient and not providing for coercion and punishment against delinquent states, but argued very cogently that punishment could not, in the nature of things, be executed on the states collectively, and therefore that such a government was necessary as could directly operate on individuals and would punish those only whose guilt required it.
Okay, so right here, Mason was seeming to be in favor of this kind of government. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what he said. And therefore, that such a government was necessary as could directly operate on individuals and would punish those whose guilt required it. I mean, he says, well, this is kind of obvious. We need to do this. And down the road, he becomes the anti-federalist because they didn't have this level of energy, this generic energy that he was expressing here. Anyway, keep going.
Mr. Sherman, who took his seat today, admitted that the Confederation had not given sufficient power to Congress and that additional powers were necessary, particularly that of raising money, which he said would involve many other powers. He admitted also that the general and particular jurisdictions ought in no case to be concurrent. He seemed, however, not to be disposed to make too great inroads on the existing system, intimating as one reason that it would be wrong to lose every amendment by inserting such as would not be agreed to by the states.
Yeah. Question on that? So if you got a question, go ahead and pause. But if not, keep going.
Okay. It was moved by Mr. Reed. I'm not sure what that is. By Mr. Coatsworth Pinckney to postpone the third proposition last offered by Mr. Randolph, vis-a-vis that a national government ought to be established consisting of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary, in order to take up the following, resolved that in order to carry into execution the design of the states in forming this convention and to accomplish the objects proposed by the Confederation, a more effective government consisting of a legislative, executive, and judiciary ought to be established.
Okay, so to help explain, when a motion is moved, when you hear it was moved, that means somebody made a motion. And that motion was to do something. That motion dies if nobody seconds it. So this is parliamentary procedures that they were functioning under. And so it was seconded by Mr. Charles Coatsworth Pinckney. That's what that meant, seconded by. So it was moved by Mr. Reed, seconded by, to help you understand the shorthand of what was being done there. It was kind of a parliamentary procedure that Madison was noting.
Yeah, it was okay. the shorthand that threw me off.
Yeah, it's okay. Just try, because if this is Madison's notes, there's going to be a lot of shorthand.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
The motion to postpone for this purpose was lost. Yeas, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Delaware, South Carolina. Four nays, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, four. On the question as moved by Mr. Butler on the third proposition, it was resolved in a committee of the whole that a national government ought to be established consisting of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary. Massachusetts being aye, Connecticut no, New York divided, Colonel Hamilton aye, Mr. Yeats no, Pennsylvania, aye. Delaware, aye. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. And South Carolina, aye.
Okay, so one of the things you'll notice, at least up in the one before that, it says yeas, Massachusetts, blah, 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 four, and then four. Nays, New York, Pennsylvania, blah, 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 four. So in other words, there were four and four, four yeas, four noes, or four nays. That means that only eight states at this point in time were in the convention. And they ended up obtaining four more. They just hadn't all shown up yet, just to let you know. Okay. So go ahead and resolve two.
Resolution two, or resolve two, of Mr. R's proposition, to wit, see May 29th. The following resolution, being the second of those proposed by Mr. Randolph, was taken up. that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned to the quotas of contribution or to the number of free inhabitants, as the one or the other rule may seem best in different cases. What are the quotas of contribution?
Okay, so Mr. Randolph, the quotas of contribution be proportioned. Okay, so in other words, this is an apportionment for the suffrage to be granted to the people of the states. That's what they're laying it out here. So let me start off, quote, that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature, in other words, how many representatives will there be to represent the people of the states, ought to be proportioned, so that representation ought to be proportioned to the quotas of contribution or to the number of free inhabitants, as the one or other rule may seem best in different cases. So in other words, when they committed or they kind of proposed this plan, they could go down one path of going down and saying, based on the number of free inhabitants, or as the quotas of contribution, in other words, those who, you know, had the means, the affluence, what have you. In other words, certain states may have had more money, and they may have been able to have more representation based on contributions. Does that make sense? So in other words, they're trying to figure out what would be the best way and the fairest way. And what ended up really coming out of all of this, because remember I said that the two, I'm going to say it now, I've said it before, and I'm probably going to say it again. The two most contentious issues that these men had to deal with was retaining and maintaining state sovereignty. That the states would not be marginalized, that they would be independent sovereign states, and that they would have equal representation in the Senate. That's what ended up panning out. That's why they created, this was a part of the Sherman Plan. So we'll get to this when we hit the Sherman Plan. But everybody was kind of pointing out, if you noticed before, Madison was presenting in the plan, or I should say Randolph for Madison, was identifying that the lower body, the first legislature, would be based on population, and that means that the more populated states would have more representation. The higher body, the Senate, would be selected or elected by those of the lower body. In other words, ensuring that almost nobody would ever make it to the Senate from the small, low-populated states, if that makes sense. Because the majority of the votes in the House are going to be from the popular states. You'll never be able to amass enough votes, you know, to ever get a small state senator in the higher legislature. It also, this part of the plan, was that the legislature would choose the president, which means that 9 times out of 10, the president would be coming from a popular state. So this is one of the reasons why the small states looked at this and go, are you kidding me? You've just thrown us into the back corner over here. We may have a little bit of suffrage in this lower house, but we have nothing to say in the upper house or as in the executive, period. Which is one of the reasons why they felt that, you know, they either you recognize our sovereignty or we're going to go. The other contention, remember there were two, the other most contentious matter that they had to deal with was slavery. And it got to a point where three states said, we're going to leave the Union, we're leaving the convention if we can't maintain slavery. That was the Carolinas and Georgia. So those were the two most contentious issues, which is why in Article 5 at the end of the convention, they created two amendment protection clauses. That one protected the state legislature's suffrage in the Senate. In other words, the Senate, our senators today cannot just vote the way they want. The state legislatures have all of the authority to tell them how they want them to vote. It's just that they're completely bamboozled into thinking they have no voice or they have no suffrage. And I heard the burst of laughter. Yeah, I know, it, you know, this is where ignorance of the Constitution, our illiteracy, is allowing the party system to run roughshod over us. And the other amendment protection clause was to ensure that the slave trade would be closed down in 1808. And in so doing, the closing down of the slave trade would literally allow the opening for free states and more free states to join the Union, to where slavery would then become abolished. And that's how it was sold when we get into the northern states. When we get into the southern states, they're going to come along. They're going to see the need for this slavery stuff. They're going to be on board with this. You watch.
And so, another thing that I notice is, like, blaringly not discussed, at least not so far, is any kind of individual rights or the federal government having any authority over people.
Right.
And I mean, like, setting the standards and the laws and regulations for individual actions and behavior outside of what the state's authority was.
Right, correct, correct. That's how it was with Continental Congress, Articles of Confederation. That's pretty much how it was going to go this way, other than those things delegated. But we can.
Right, I'm saying as in contrast with people's illiterate views today of thinking that the Constitution, you know, somehow grants them some kind of rights.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the thinking of this day was that if you're a free individual, then you have rights given by God. The government doesn't have any authority in that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So,
all right.
Madison then pipes up, because now that we've clarified, what did he mean by this proportion of quotas of contribution or free inhabitants?
So, Mr. Madison, observing that the words "or to the number of free inhabitants" might occasion debates which would divert the committee from the general question whether the principle of representation should be changed, moved that they might be struck out.
Okay. So this is where fundamentally we look at, when we come down to government, who has a right to representation? Now, as far as I'm concerned, if government has the authority to cause you harm, you should automatically have right to representation. In other words, you should have influence and the ability to demand, you know, that your representative hear your side. As a constituent, you should be able to, you know, approach and instruct and provide guidance and so forth. So in the House of Representatives, when we give them the power to declare war, that includes everybody, doesn't it?
Yes.
It does now, because it includes women. Right? I mean, when we look at who can go to war, who can even be combatants, both men and women now. Congress set the standard. Congress has the power to set that standard. So I believe that
any... So women are registering for selective service now?
They should be. There shouldn't be a double standard. Equal protection under the law. So if they've set the standard, now it's not that they have, but if they set the standard, that's how it should be. The federal government has, we're going to get into this, that they can't pick sides. They can't pick favorites. They say, you know, okay, it's all on the guys. When they opened the door and said women can do and can be, then it's equal protection. Then the men have that equal right of protection as well under the law. So that means that they're all in the queue. Right, wrong, or indifferent, when Congress felt, you know, to empower women by making them warriors, and that they, you know, they can equally go because women want to do that, well, those few women ruined it for everybody, because government can't pick sides. So if they open the door, they have to open the door completely.
Well, they haven't. I just looked it up.
No, I understand that.
Selective service currently mandates only male U.S. citizens.
I understand that, yes. I completely understand that. No, I'm just saying that that's how it should be.
Right. Well, okay. I don't think that's how it should be from a principal standpoint, but according to the interpretation that we're currently living under, that's the way it should be. But you see, that's where you get into the argument of, if you've been in combat and you've been in military, and it's not a misogynist point of view, it's just natural, you know, instinct that it's not the best to have females in a combat situation for anyone that's involved.
No. So I'm not trying to take a moral high ground here.
No.
I'm just trying to say that when Congress says that both sexes can go to combat, both sexes then need to have equal obligations in all things, because there were at certain points in time there were these little fine lines. Women were, you know, allowed to do service supports, like, you know, food service, supply, those types of things, but they could not be in combat arms or anything that would put them in danger. But as far as I'm concerned, the Constitution basically establishes the standard of age, not sex. It establishes the age of service, and that's it. I mean, the states were the ones that were establishing the sex. And so when Congress said that women now can and will, they have this law, technically, as soon as you understand, Congress has no authority in the Constitution to establish a draft or to dictate anything other than the apportionment of bodies that need to come from the states when calling forth the militia. The states are the ones that are supposed to be, based on the standards Congress gives them, they're supposed to be able to maintain the requisite number to support the need for the national, as well as to support their standing operational. So in other words, if they had to call forth the militia, it's best guess for the federal calling forth, the state would have its best guess of trying to have at least enough people engaged in the active militia in the state so that they would still have an adequate number of militia in the state when Congress just pulled, you know, many of their active service out to go form their new army, to do the execution of the laws, or to repel the invasion, whatever they're calling them for, those 3 points. So Congress has no authority whatsoever to establish a draft in the Constitution. The militia is to be maintained by the states. Congress has the responsibility and power to call forth the militia from the states. Those states better be ready to provide. That's it. So I'm just diving into really where's the power, what power do they have, and Congress would set those standards. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, we're any better of a nation by putting women in harm's way, or by putting women into, you know, combat arms, or even putting them into service. But there's a lot of women that want that to do that. I would think that to change that, to fundamentally change that part as a nation, would require a constitutional amendment, not an administrative decision, if that makes sense. Because I think that's one of those cultural things that many states, you know, have this huge barrier of saying, you know, women don't do those things, period. We're not putting women into, you know, combat arms. It was Congress that basically tried to force that. Had the states basically said, you know what, you want to do that, you want to add sex, because all this time the sex was men. Now you want to open it up to women. You need to actually amend the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14. In calling forth the militia, or in 15, identifying that the militia will be, and laying it out. So this way the states can literally determine whether they want their women to go or not. And let's see how that would have shaken out. Instead of Congress basically exercising this general value. So this goes down to the language put into the Constitution didn't give them the ability to include One would think that, you know, it didn't say sex at all. At that point in time, it was a cultural thing. It was the unmentioned, and it was common knowledge and generally understood. Men. But now things have changed, and I think over time, I think the state should have pushed back, and I think the states could have pushed back and said, you need to amend the Constitution for us to grant you that kind of power. And ergo, the states probably should have, you know, demanded a constitutional amendment to ensure that only men would be deployed as a part of the national, you know, this national army, this national military, in doing those types of things, period. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir, it does.
Okay. But the way things have gone and the way Congress has assumed, and based on the fact that Congress can't pick favors, I mean, we'll get into that when we go through the ratification debates as well as the convention here. It'll be pointed out that Congress will not be able to, you know, favor one port over another port, or favor one city or one state over another. Okay, so Madison basically put that out there. We hadn't read into King, right? Because we got about 2 minutes left.
All right, I'll go ahead, Mr. King.
Okay.
Mr. King observed that the quotas of contribution, which would alone remain as the measure of representation, would not answer, because waiving every other view of the matter, the revenue might hereafter be so collected by the general government that the sums respectively drawn from the states would not appear and would besides be continually varying.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
Okay, yep. Okay, so Mr. Madison.
I don't know. That whole situation of what we just talked about mm-hmm. the quotas of contribution, mm-hmm. it seems so alien in my mind, just thinking about it, how it was a totally different perspective at the time of when they were doing this of how things would be. Like the richest states, the states who paid in the most revenue mm-hmm. would get the most representation. It seems like graft in the making.
Yes, and you'll realize that the southern states had the money. If you mm-hmm. look at the northern states, you know, Delaware, Connecticut, New Hampshire, the only state to the north that kind of had money because it was just bigger, but we already know that they were having financial problems because of the Shays Rebellion. So as we look, there was a huge difference between the agrarian society and this, you know, the factories and the commerce of the north, where they didn't have huge plantations. And yes, you're going to find that we're going to dive into these issues of property, because they're going to talk about assessing property for determining taxation and everything else. We've ran out of time. I appreciate the fact that you're astute and you're picking these things up, because these things, they're going to dive into these things and argue, and this is one of the reasons why it settles on the apportionment of people, not of contribution. But then again, it's still ambiguous as far as the people goes. They really didn't dive into that. And so we can pick that up if you want to. Tomorrow is a go back. If you want to write that down, let's dive into the apportionment of people, as you know, how that kind of represented instead of how it played out as we see it. I'm Jerry Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.